Hello and welcome to the Africa Today podcast from the BBC at 15:30 GMT on Thursday, the 22nd of July. I'm Audrey Brown, and in the pod today, the Somali crisis blows all other topics off the agenda at an African foreign minister's meeting in Kampala.
Sanitation, maternal health, human development can only be done effectively within the context of peace and security. The continent is carrying a collective guilt and collective shame about our inability to assist Somalia.
Zimbabwe takes action against ethnic tensions among refugees from the Great Lakes region, and we ask if President Kagame's media advisor is happy with the country's image ahead of elections next month. Sessions have begun at the African Union Summit in Kampala. Now, although the theme is maternal, infant and child health and development in Africa, ministers also have to deal with other pressing issues, including the deteriorating situation in Somalia and how to support the African Union peacekeeping mission in Mogadishu. So far, only Uganda and Burundi have sizable numbers of troops in the force, and Uganda paid a price for this more than a week ago when suicide bombers struck two venues in Kampala, killing over 70 people. The BBC's Joshua Mali is at the summit in Kampala, and he told Hassan Aruni what's been the focus.
The issue of security, regional security, and Somalia has been so much on people's lips here. To an extent that some women organizations have been complaining, and then I even spoke to the Kenyan Foreign Affairs Minister, Moses Wetangula, and this is what he said.
Every delegation that took the floor is talking about what must be done or what ought to be done about Somalia. It's with a clear understanding that sanitation, maternal health, human development can only be done effectively within the context of peace and security. And you can see the continent is carrying a collective guilt and collective shame about our inability to assist Somalia come out of the dubious status of a failed state.
The Kenyan Foreign Minister, Moses Wetangula, there. Now, Joshua, what about officials from Somalia? What are they saying?
Indeed, I spoke to the Defense Minister of the Transitional Federal Government of Somalia, Abubakar Abdi Osman, and he did express a lot of concern about what's happening in Somalia. He said they need a lot of support. And in short, this is what he said.
AU is our brothers. They are sharing, you know, the problems with us, you know, in Somalia. So we prefer African Union, you know, force to be there, but to be strong. We need more numbers. Small number, which we have today, you know, sent by Ugandan government and Burundian government, is not going to be enough. What we need is more numbers, more than 20,000, more than 40,000, more than 50,000. This is the way we can defeat, you know, these people.
Very recently, after the bombing in Kampala, President Museveni suggested that the mandate should change from peacekeeping to peace enforcement. Are you in support of that view?
Yes, we support. We need, you know, that to happen. We need more forces to come in. We need, you know, more forces, you know, from Africa, from IGAD, and from United Nations, from everywhere we get, you know, forces, we support.
The Somali Minister of Defense, Abubakar Abdi Osman, speaking to Joshua Mali at the AU Foreign Ministers meeting in Kampala. All this week, an international AIDS conference has been taking place in Vienna. Now, while there's been news of exciting developments in the field of research, there are also growing concerns that progress made so far in the fight against HIV/AIDS could slow down if funding for treatment is reduced. This especially in the light of the current global economic climate. To find out what's been discussed and decided, Paul Bachibinga has been speaking to Evelyn Kibuchi, director of the Kenya AIDS NGO consortium, KANCO.
Most of the issues that have been discussed first is to appreciate the much funds that have been received from Global Fund, especially that has been geared towards Africa. There has also been discussions on how to raise more funding to bridge the gap that has been there. For example, there have been discussions about innovative funding.
What do you mean by innovative funding?
Innovative funding is looking for alternative means of funding health initiatives instead of wholly relying on donors. This is like introducing tax on some services. For instance, we have good examples of innovative funding that has been demonstrated by UNITAID, where they have placed a tax on air ticketing, and this has been this has been an initiative that other governments have been requested to take. Like, I'll give an example in my country where there's a proposal to tax airtime, those funds go to support health initiatives.
So basically, the developed world is saying that Africa might be on their own soon.
Well, we are not saying we are going to be on our own soon, but I think it's a high time that we started thinking of how we can support our own health programs without 100% relying on donors. Other initiatives that I think have been discussed is like what we call debt to health. And this is where donor countries are requested to cancel, not really cancel debt, but instead of them receiving the payment of debt that African countries owe them, they convert these debts to address health issues. So we call that debt to health.
Are there any areas of concern that you think the conference hasn't addressed?
Personally, I think there are some issues that have been neglected in the discussions here. The first one that I really think needs to be addressed more is the investment on research, and particularly for TB. We have had so much investments in research for HIV, for example, the HIV vaccine, but little has been done about TB. For instance, we are using TB drugs that are over 50 years old. Nothing much has been done to come up with new drugs, and I'm thinking this is a neglected area. The other thing is, I think much as we are talking about investing in health, I think we also need to look into more basic issues like funding infrastructure to alleviate poverty, because I think a number of the health problems are brought about by poverty. And so if we could direct more funds to funding poverty, that would alleviate half the problems.
Evelyn Kibuchi, director of the Kenya AIDS NGO Consortium, KANCO, speaking from the AIDS conference in Vienna. An investigation by the BBC into conditions at a camp in Zimbabwe for refugees from the Great Lakes region has revealed an ugly picture of social tensions and sexual violence. Zimbabwe's government has expelled 5 of the residents from the country, accusing them of fomenting ethnic divisions. The Tongogara refugee camp in southeast Zimbabwe is home to some 5,000 refugees. Our reporter Brian Hungwe has been there to find out what's going on.
Tucked inside a commercial farmland, away from the glare of the public, is Tongogara refugee camp, about 500 miles from the capital Harare. Closely knit grass-thatched huts swirl around the camp, running about a mile. It's home to thousands of refugees from the Great Lakes region fleeing conflict. Here, they are refugees from about 10 countries, all under one roof. Inside the camp, church services are commonplace. Some continue to pray for peace and for God to ease the tension getting out of control within the camp. The atmosphere here is tense. Two groups, both claiming to be Burundians, divided. Now, very few people want to talk. Suspicions are running deep and the tension has been heightened. John Peter Harizimana has lived at the camp for the past 4 years and belongs to the group of so-called non-Burundians, and he warned the camp was on the precipice.
Surely if they probably continue like that, it must automatically become resulting in the violence, because myself, I was also a refugee in Tanzania in 1996, whereby this such conflict happened in a camp called Kitare, even the other camp called Rukore in Kagera province, whereby even this problem were happening, whereby the Burundian who comes straight from Burundi will not agree or understand the Burundian who come from Rwanda. So this kind of is not starting today. It has happened even long before.
Harizimana told me that leadership positions are contested and elected, and those born inside Burundi want to occupy positions of authority inside the camp. This has led to tension within the Burundian refugees, numbering close to 2,000. Some of the original Burundians who refused to talk on tape told me the non-Burundians were arming themselves. As I walked around the camp, the Burundian refugees sat in groups. The grouping that considered itself original Burundians refused to talk to me. The government and United Nations have tried to ease the tension, but they have so far failed to do so. Social Welfare Minister Pauline Mpariwa says if the government hadn't acted in expelling the five ringleaders of the grouping calling itself the original Burundian refugees, the situation was going to get out of control.
They were actually attacking each other and using abusive languages on each other. Yet alone, they are all refugees, and they are being hosted by government through my ministry. And we had to take some stance in saying the five that were arrested in terms of the problems, I have actually endorsed that they be returned. As an example, one, to say we will not allow divisions, we will not allow problems that arise from another group attacking another group.
While the tension continues to rise inside the camp, something else is happening to over 50 young people. Sexual abuse. 15-year-old Tara, not her real name, is 2 months pregnant. She tells me she was raped.
He forced me, say, oh, I must do sex with you.
And he forced you?
Yeah. What I know is a force. But in fact, what he did, he forced. Yeah, like to make me pregnant is bad to me because I'm still a school child.
Minutes after the interview, Tara's father reported the matter to the police, leading to an arrest. In a closed private session with UNHCR official, 36 of the mainly young girls said they had secrets to tell. After escaping one type of violence in the Great Lakes region, they are now having to come face to face with more abuse in the refugee camp.
The BBC's Brian Hungwe with that exclusive report from Tongogara refugee camp in southeast Zimbabwe. There's a presidential election coming up in Rwanda in less than 3 weeks, but a dark shadow is hovering over this. It would seem that someone, somewhere, is trying to kill critics of the president, Paul Kagame. There was the bungled attack in June against an exiled senior military officer in South Africa. Less than a week later, in Kigali, two unidentified men shot dead the assistant editor of a banned newspaper. Then at the start of this month, a senior opposition leader was found dead in Butare, and some opposition politicians have been arrested. Now, an international media rights group is calling for European Union aid to Rwanda to be suspended. President Kagame's media advisor, Dr. Alfred Ndahiro, is in London, and Hassan Aruni asked him if he was happy with the country's image at the moment.
Well, for some reason, people are distorting the image of Rwanda. And especially during this pre-election period, you know. So what can we do?
People are distorting. You mean there's a plot against Rwanda?
It looks like there's a plot, really.
Who hates Rwanda that much?
Oh, Rwanda still has lots of enemies, although it has lots of admirers as well. But, you know, there are people who are associated with the old regime, the killers, and... They've really done everything to distort the image of Rwanda and the image of the President Kagame.
But when you have a situation where, for example, there was this bungled attack in June against an exiled senior military officer in South Africa, less than a week later, two unidentified gunmen shot dead the assistant editor of a banned newspaper. Then at the start of this month, a senior opposition leader was found dead in the second largest city, Butare. You can't say this is all happening from outside Rwanda.
You've mentioned three cases, all right? Shall I start with the middle one?
Let's go.
The killer of this person has been identified.
The journalist.
The journalist, yes. And the killer has actually confessed to the crime. Now, which person in his right of mind would want to confess to a crime that he never committed?
I don't know. Where there are other interests at play, all sorts of things could happen. But that's not, you know, it's not for me to judge. But yeah. What about the general in South Africa?
Well, again, in this case, four people have been identified. None of them is a Rwandan. There are two Tanzanians, one Somali, I understand, and one Mozambican. Now, again, I think we should leave the South African police to carry out their investigations rather than jump on conclusions that the government of Rwanda is directly involved in
this.
Yes,
but back home in Rwanda, you have a situation as well where two newspapers have been closed, one is in court, one has been forced to operate online only. It's almost as if there is a tightening of the grip and a clampdown on freedom of expression. Who is afraid of what?
No one is afraid of newspapers and, you know, journalists. But you should not assume that journalists in Rwanda are angels. They are human beings like you and me. they can break laws, and when they break laws, they are called upon to account for that. So if they do, there's no reason why the whole world should be up in arms that Rwanda is clamping on journalists and gagging them, in a sense.
Dr. Alfred Ndahiro, media advisor to Rwanda's President Paul Kagame. That's it for today. Thank you for downloading the Africa Today podcast from the BBC, recorded weekdays at 15:30 GMT. I'm Audrey Brown, and until next time, goodbye.